Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Overnight America with Ryan Recker on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
And welcome to Overnight America. You know that sound where it goes from everything's all humming, then it drops down and pops back up. I hate that sound. You're like, oh, great. That sound is the sound of you're going to spend the weekend in the garage trying to work on whatever machine you know is about to break down. And that's a terrible sound. Lots to get to on the show tonight. And we're just a couple of minutes away from our friend Rich Rubino. He has the book American Politics on the Rocks. We check in with him on Mondays. And certainly there's a lot to get to. Lots and lots to get to. I didn't realize this until I did a little bit of research, but there's three Democratic debates next month. Who in their right mind can handle three debates without going crazy? That sounds like torture. That's something they would put the prisoners over at Gitmo, put them to watch that debate over and over and over again, and we'll tell you anything you want. Just get it away. Senator Josh Hawley introducing measures to dismiss the bogus articles of impeachment. Maybe I'll ask Rich Rubino about that, too. Joaquin Phoenix and Ricky Gervais really stealing the show last night. We did the show, and every Sunday on Overnight America, every once in a while, there's something live going on. And the Golden Globes, I wasn't going to talk about it last night, but thanks to the comedian Ricky Gervais, I did. And I loved it so much, I'm going to play it again. Next hour, we're going to be joined by the author Kevin Miller. He has a book out, and he says, you better tread pretty carefully when you do those DNA tests. You might not be prepared what you'll find. And we're going to ask him about his story and how his family life was turned upside down based on digging into the family history. That's next hour. Also, Tom Voss is a co-author of a book, Where War Ends, Recover from PTSD and Moral Injury Through Not Medication, but Meditation. So it's an interesting take there. We'll talk to Tom Voss in the next hour. I'm sure there's a lot of people that may have things impacted that way. I have ABC up, and I also have Fox News up, and then I have NBC, and in the other room, CNN and MSNBC and all them. There's different monitors looking at all the different stations. Looks like on Fox News, they're really focusing on Iran. We may cover some of that tonight. I got to tell you this. I think a lot of people are going to be pushing and grabbing for whatever the next topic's going to be in the matter of the end of the week. I feel like this Iran thing, and it's so funny because anytime we have these conflicts, it's almost like the same thing over and over again. United States reacts to someone doing something somewhere. Everyone goes crazy because they think it's going to be World War III. 5 days later, no one's talking about it. I wonder if we're going to be in that same cycle, because even doing the topic on the show last night, I thought, oh yeah, everyone's going to want to talk about Iran. We had all this stuff that popped up over the weekend. Oh, so-and-so talked over here. Oh, so-and-so did this. Oh, look at who's saying this over here. Oh, look at what happened over there. No one cared. If that was the test to find out if there was true interest or people actually believed this was going to start another world war, I'm not seeing it. And I think a lot of people are trying to push this as hard as they can right now because they're in a lull. You know, the articles impeachment going nowhere. They're in a lull. They were so spoiled with the whole impeachment hearings going on. Yeah, they got to move on to something else because it's kind of in a low point. So they got to find a way to spin the United States taking out a terrorist, and they got to find a way to spin that as a bad thing somehow. And, well, they're trying their hardest, aren't they? Bless their little hearts, that mainstream media. I wanted to mention, too, that there's that one bet that was announced last week, and I'm so glad it's happening, between Justin Bieber. He's the Canadian musician that was a big heartthrob there for a while. I don't think he is much anymore, but he's still a very popular musician. He's such a popular musician. He's a worldwide sensation. He's probably an A-plus style musician. So if he goes anywhere, he's going to sell out immediately. One of those type of, you know, he can sell out Enterprise, no problem. That's kind of like the test, right? If you can sell out Enterprise, no problem, then you're pretty good. If it's a smaller venue, you know, you could be good, but you're just not that same level of entertainer. Well, he is going to be fulfilling a bet with our Blues goaltender, Jordan Binnington. And there's been a little update on that. And it looks like there's all signs pointing that they may try to hook this up during the All-Star game. Wouldn't that be great? They're going to do a little shootout. If the superstar can score on Jordan Binnington, the musician, Justin Bieber, they're basically going to donate money to charity. Whoever's the loser donates money to charity. Well, some other corporate sponsors want in on this, which is pretty cool. I want in on it, too. So I talked to a friend of ours just down the hall from our sister station, Y98. Paul Cook and I are going to be also betting on the players. I'm going to be betting on behalf of Jordan Binnington since they played Justin Bieber over on Y98. He's going to bet that Justin Bieber is going to win it. I'm excited. I'm excited to announce this bet that we're going to have because whoever's going to be the loser of this, it's not going to be good for them. Got so much to get to on the show. So much to get to. Harvey Weinstein, first day in trial, lots of insults going back and forth, and rightfully so. You know, and let's get to our friend Rich Rubino in just a couple minutes. We're going to go to break. We'll check in with him. I know The Bachelor's tonight. There's probably a lot of similarities between The Bachelor and the Democratic convention that's going to be coming up here soon. It's Overnight America, KMOX.
Now back to Overnight America on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
I want to thank anyone that listens to us every night. Thank you. It is a, I mean, it does mean a lot. It really does to know that people enjoy this show and that you're there and we're on it together. It's kind of cool to know that even though I'm sitting alone in a room right now in this studio, that there's still, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of people that are listening all across the United States right at this very moment. So thank you. On Mondays, we hook up with our friend Rich Rubino. He's the author of the book, American Politics on the Rocks. Rich, thanks for coming back on to Overnight America.
Oh, good. Glad to be here.
I know. How did your New Year and Christmas go?
Relatively well. Relatively well. How about you?
Really good. No Adam Sandler sightings at this time of year?
No, I think he's actually gone right now, but I know that there have been people in town who have been happy because he's done some interviews and he always has hats from different stores around the town that he had been a customer at. So people are seeing that, and those are obviously great promotions.
Yeah. So right now, ABC is debuting The Bachelor. It's a 3-hour special. It reminds me of what the DNC is going to be going through here shortly.
Lots of
excitement.
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
So their reality show has been going on for a long time. The ABC reality show will be a finite, but I feel like this spectacle could be going on for a while. I wanted to get an update from you regarding the different polls that we see, and it seems like what you've been talking about on this show is starting to play out very clearly. Though people are really spending a lot of time in Iowa, that may not be the thing that means anything considering the Bloomberg effect. He may be out there trying to hit the other states. It's going to be a true wild card this year. I wanted to get your take on some of the movement in the polls. Have any of the candidates started to sprout up?
Yeah, well, what's interesting, first of all, I've always said that there's going to be a candidate. Our couple candidates in the last few weeks of the campaign, their poll numbers are going to proliferate as people make their decisions, like in 2004 with John Kerry and John Edwards. They were not at the top of the pack. The last few weeks, they moved up. In that case, it was Dick Gephardt and Howard Dean going after each other. It became Mushisher Destruction. And then once you got the Iowa caucuses, John Kerry finishes first, John Edwards finishes second. I think we've seen so far Pete Buttigieg, who, you know, when he announced, he had very de minimis name recognition. Very few people outside of Selfman, Indiana, knew who this guy was. Now you look at polls that are actually showing him actually in the lead in some polls in New Hampshire and Iowa, which is really amazing considering how low his name recognition was at the beginning. But the other one is Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota. And her deal in terms of what she's doing in Iowa is she's going to all 99 counties in Iowa. So she's visiting the places, some of whom are very conservative, parts of Iowa where there are very few votes to get in some of those caucuses, but she's spending a lot of her time on all these parts of the state, and polls are now showing her getting to 7-8%. I think she's somebody who potentially could go into second or third place on the idea of the Iowa caucuses.
Wow.
Also, her message is something which I think resonates with rural Iowa voters specifically. Now, obviously, there's only so many rural voters to Gardner, because in Iowa, a lot of those people are Republicans. But of those who actually go to the caucuses, you know, she's really working that constituency. It's a constituency that, for example, helped Tom Harkin win his Senate races all those years. You know, so I think she has a very good shot at becoming second or third. And also, she's from Minnesota, and she's focusing on rural issues, which I think a lot of other candidates are kind of feel somewhat uncomfortable about, but she knows about agricultural-type issues, and she's making her case that she's electable. So she's somebody who I think you can see, you definitely see a proliferation in poll numbers. And the other one is, you notice Bernie Sanders in some of these polls is now ahead.
Oh, yeah.
Including in polls in Nevada. When he had his heart attack, I think some people thought that it was kind of the death knell of his political campaign, but he's really come back with a vengeance. I think he got AOC's endorsement, and he's gotten a lot of the support that I think was kind of between him and Elizabeth Warren, and now you're seeing polls showing Elizabeth Warren a distant fourth place with Joe Biden, Mayor Buttigieg, and Bernie Sanders at the top. So I think you might see in the next couple of debates, you know, Elizabeth Warren in many respects has to go after Bernie Sanders, which she hasn't done so far. But a lot of those people on the left, I think, are going toward Bernie Sanders. They're seeing that he is galvanized, he is energized, and they see that him as somebody who's potentially electable in the general election. So that's a potential problem for her.
I honestly don't get Klobuchar. I don't understand why she's rising in the polls. Anytime I've seen her, she seems very stiff. She doesn't seem all that personable. But then again, she's not eating salad with a hairbrush, so I guess that's a positive. With the all the other candidates that continue to rise, it's fascinating to see them trying to spend as much money as they can. You keep hearing updates of who's fundraising the most, and it seems like Bernie Sanders has been doing gangbusters there. Tons of support. Which, does that ever really translate to polls?
It can. I mean, part of it is the money that he's getting is obviously he's getting a lot of free media because a lot of attention. He's on the front page of, you know, New Hampshire and Iowa papers because of how he's doing, and people are saying, oh, there's momentum in this person's campaign. Now, obviously, there were examples. Ron Paul, for example, in 2008, who was able to raise a lot of money, but that did not necessarily translate into votes. What Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, is doing, you were talking about this earlier, is he's spending a lot of his time. He's basically ignoring the first four states, and he's spending all of his time in places like California, New York, which go either Super Tuesday or beyond that. He actually has an office in the Virgin Islands, believe it or not. The first candidate to actually have an office where there are very few delegates.
Oh, wow.
Of the U.S. Virgin Islands, but he's spending a lot of time in those types of places. It's really hard for me, though, to imagine where his message, and he's spending a lot of money, too, that's the reason I mention it, would resonate with Democratic voters. And in many respects, he's seen as somewhat too conservative or too moderate or too close to corporations, too close to Wall Street at a time when it's a very anti-Wall Street-centric Democratic Party. But there are states that have open primaries, and I think he's somehow counting on the states that have open primaries. They can potentially benefit there.
Wow. It's funny. It's untraditional. You see, a lot has changed since the 2016 election. I think people are realizing that most every election from here on out, there's going to be something non-traditional about it. Rich Rubino, our guest this hour, in his book, American Politics on the Rocks. Again, if people wanted to look you up online, where can they find you?
Yeah, you can go to Rich Rubino on Facebook or just go to www.polita-geek.com.
You know, and historically speaking, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the impeachment because our senator here in Missouri, Josh Hawley, had a pretty good speech today, and I had a chance to watch it, about 8 minutes long or however it was, and basically saying it's never taken this long to turn in the articles of impeachment. They had the hearing, it was signed off on, and then Nancy Pelosi holds on to it. He basically wants to put a timetable onto it, saying that you have to at least submit it within these so many calendar days for it to actually be, or it'll just dissolve. And I wanted to talk to you historically about that. He mentioned that this has never been held on to as long in the past. And we look at some of the other proceedings that went on as well. He's right about that. I wanted to maybe ask you about the way that this impeachment is being held and the way you see it continue to be dragged out. Is there any similarities to any of the impeachments we've seen in the past?
Not directly like this. I think the closest, though, there was a motion in the Clinton impeachment back in 1999, after he was impeached and before he was before the Senate trial. There was a movement by Senator Byrd from West Virginia, which would have dismissed the allegations outright.
Huh.
And he actually got the Republicans. It was a Republican-controlled Senate. Trent Lott was the majority leader, and they agreed to bring the motion up about 2 weeks after the proceedings had begun, and it was actually voted on. And basically, all Republicans voted against it. The Democrats, except for Russ Feingold, kind of a maverick from Wisconsin, voted for the resolution. So it wasn't necessarily passed, and then it went on, and the trial continued. And it was kind of interesting because Byrd was somebody who was actually very critical of Bill Clinton. Chuck Schumer, for example, in 1998, Bill Clinton was campaigning for Chuck Schumer, and Chuck Schumer was a member of the House of Representatives on the Judiciary Committee. And if there was an impeachment, there would be a lame duck session, so he would still be on the House Judiciary Committee, even if whether he gets elected as senator or not to the Senate. And so he would be on the trial of he would be on that committee when Bill Clinton's impeachment came up. So he was saying, don't mess with this jury. In other words, you're going out campaigning for Chuck Schumer. You're trying to persuade his vote. Mm-hmm. So he had been somewhat critical of him, but then he talked about how the reason he wanted this motion to dismiss was because of the institution of the United States Senate and the institution of impeachment. He talked about how it went back 700 years. He talked about all the kings of England, that type of thing. And he said that it's more so for the institution than it is for William Jefferson Clinton, who was actually pretty critical of him. I mean, to the point that he literally would not appear to go to his State of the Union addresses. Mm. And he was a Democrat. And so that was probably the thing that I would say is closest to this. But, you know, the other argument, some people say, well, if you don't actually send the articles to the Senate, does that mean technically that President Trump is not impeached? I guess that's a constitutional question as well.
I know, as people are going to call it however they want to call it in that sense. It's fascinating, you know.
Oh, yes.
And never, if you want to be play it by the books, I understand, technically speaking, it doesn't actually count until it's, because it gets out of the hearing, it votes, but maybe there's another term for it they'll have to make up, because I don't think anyone would envisioned this scenario where they would vote on it, they would approve it, and then they wouldn't do anything with it.
That's such a weird scenario.
What about, maybe you can help refresh my memory, because I really don't remember what happened. So after the trial in the Senate for Bill Clinton.
Yep.
Did he go out and campaign for other candidates after that, or was he pretty much laying it low until the end of his presidency?
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, so what happened, basically 1998, he wasn't impeached. He was impeached. So 1998, he went out and campaigned, and this was before he was impeached. And actually that election, the Democratic Party won seats in the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time in a six-year presidency that a party in power won seats since James Monroe in 1820. Mm-hmm. That's how long that had been, or 1822 rather, and they barely had political parties back then. They were different. So Bill Clinton picked up seats, and he had gone campaigning basically all over the country. His job approval rating was still in the 60s. Then after that, there was the impeachment came up in the Congress after he had gone out and campaigned for people. Mm-hmm. And then the impeachment, then eventually the Senate acquitted him. But while he was, first of all, during that time period, he went to King Hussein's funeral. He was campaigning about Social Security reform. He was signing executive orders. So he continued to govern. Mm-hmm. And then what happened, the next presidential election, would have been 2000. And Al Gore made what some believe was a campaign-altering mistake when he said that Bill Clinton should not be on the campaign trail for him.
Oh, yeah.
Now, there were a lot of advocates who said that Bill Clinton has a 65% job approval rating. Get him on the campaign trail. Get him to Michigan. Get him to his home state in Arkansas. Get him around the country to campaign for you. But Al Gore, except for this one instance where they're in Michigan and Clinton hands off the baton essentially to Al Gore, basically wanted him to stay away. Bill Clinton wanted to get off campaign. He wanted to campaign for Al Gore. He went off and campaigned for other Senate and House candidates. But Al Gore kept saying, I want to show you who I truly am. And I think what he was trying to do when he took a gamble, he tried to say that he was essentially that he did not prescribe to the morals of Bill Clinton. So essentially he said, I'm my own man. So he would go out and campaign and barely mention Bill Clinton. Or if he did, he'd say the Clinton-Gore administration did this to always put himself in terms of the accomplishments, but he didn't want necessarily to be. He saw it as a bigger liability, but that was not the conventional thinking in the Democratic Party. The conventional thinking was get him onto the campaign trail. Finally, in the last week or so of the campaign, Bill Clinton did go out and campaign for Al Gore. He actually appeared in Arkansas the Sunday before the Tuesday of the election. He campaigned for Gore and he campaigned for Mike Ross, who was running for a seat in the 4th Congressional District in Arkansas, which includes Hot Springs and Hope, which were his two boyhood homes. Mike Ross barely won re-election there, but Al Gore ended up losing the state. Had he won Arkansas, had he won his home state of Tennessee, had he won New Hampshire, which all states which Bill Clinton had won, in both of his two, in 92 and 96, Al Gore would have been president despite what happens in Florida. Yeah. But so he did go on the campaign trail, and Democrats wanted him on the campaign trail. And, you know, obviously when you have a 65% job approval rating, you are more of an asset than a liability for people running for the Senate and the House, any down-ballot candidates. But in Al Gore's case, he made that gamble, and he's always been blamed for it. And supposedly there was a meeting about a month later when Al Gore walked into the Oval Office, and Bill Clinton said, you know, nobody's going to blame you for Monica Lewinsky. And they got into a fight. And then later on, I guess what happened was there was a funeral in Tennessee, and they were both at the funeral, and they kind of made up, and they became political. They became allies once again, but there had been kind of a standoff between the two because of that.
Wow. Wouldn't you like to hear some of those conversations, fly-in-the-wall conversations of them trying to decide during the Gore campaign if they were going to try to use or try to avoid using the president, a two-term sitting president that has a high approval rating,
job rating,
all that stuff. That's a tough call. You want to know who was the deciding person, if it was Al Gore, if there was someone he was listening to for that.
Well, I'll say there was one other issue, too. And the other issue that Gore was afraid of was, for example, in West Virginia, Bill Clinton had supported Mountaintop, had supported some restrictions on coal mining, which was alienating some voters in West Virginia. In West Virginia that year, actually, despite the fact that Gore didn't have Clinton campaign for, George W. Bush became the first president, first Republican president since Herbert Hoover in 1928 to win the state of West Virginia as a first-term president.
Mm.
And the other state was Tennessee because Bill Clinton had supported regulation of tobacco, and that had a deleterious effect specifically on some of the farmers in Tennessee. So that was one of the other fear that Al Gore had. He wanted to see himself as differentiating himself from Bill Clinton in that respect as well.
You might hold it on. I got some more questions
for
you. We'll do that after the break. I do want to talk about Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren, some things that happened to them recently. I also want to talk about Iran. A lot of people have been mentioning, a lot of people on the left, I should say, Democrats right now are saying that President Trump's abusing his power with the way he's handling Iran. I think it's par for the course, but I wanted to get your take on how the presidents have handled instances like this where there's been certain campaigns, bombings, reactions. So we'll talk to Rich Rubino coming up right after the break. His book, American Politics on the Rocks. Check it out on Amazon. Get it on Amazon. It's Overnight America, KMOX.
This is Overnight America with Ryan Recker on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
We continue, and we want to thank our guest, Rich Rubino, who joins us on the TDK Technologies guest line. He's the author of American Politics on the Rocks. Rich, again, if people wanted to look you up online, where can they find you?
Yep, just go to www.polita-geek.com or just go to Facebook and type in Rich Rubino.
Historically speaking, presidents have carried out bombing campaigns, drone strikes, things like that, and it doesn't seem like they always go to Congress to get approval before that happens. It almost seems par for the course, but people are making it sound like the way President Trump's handling Iran is any different. I wanted to get your context, maybe how other presidents have handled this, and is there anything different about Trump's handling Iran?
Yeah, well, basically what it says in the Constitution, the Congress has the power to declare war, but the president is commander-in-chief of the Army and the Navy. And most constitutional scholars have interpreted that to mean that essentially the president, if, for example, if there were to be attack, if there would be an imminent attack, the president could retaliate without having to go to Congress and get an approval. But, you know, essentially in the United what happens in the United States Congress since World War II is the last time Congress officially, which is constitutionally required, declared war. What happened in Korea is Harry Truman was president, and this was the Korean War in 1950 to 1953. And Truman sent troops under the guise calling it a quote-unquote police action. So he kept sending it. It was a ground war. He said it was part of a U.N. charter. And that precedent, in terms of having a police action rather than a war, continued in Vietnam. When Presidents Kennedy and Johnson sent troops over there, they did not get the Congress to declare war. But in 1964, President Johnson, after there was after the Gulf of Tonkin incident occurred, he got what was called the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution passed through the House and the Senate. It passed unanimously in the House of Representatives. In the Senate, there were only two dissenting votes, and basically that gave President Johnson carte blanche to do whatever he wanted in Vietnam. So, in other words, it's called Congress authorizes him to use the force in the police action as opposed to specifically declaring war. And that's what happened, for example, you know, when war was not declared in Grenada in 1983. It wasn't declared in Kosovo in 1999. It hasn't been declared in any war since then. But basically, there's what's called the War Powers Resolution. And this passed in 1973, based on a Democratic Congress. The American people were fed up with Vietnam and the increase in the Vietnam War, the fact that, you know, basically they thought the country had been lied to. The Pentagon Papers came out and had showed that fact under Kennedy and Johnson administrations. And it was called the War Powers Resolution, which basically requires that the president notify within 48 hours the United States Congress when he's armed, when he's authorized military action. and then it forbids them from keeping those forces for another 60 days unless the Congress essentially approves it. So that's basically what is in the Constitution. And the War Powers Act, whether that's constitutional or not, is a question for the courts. But what President Trump has done is not that much different than what previous presidents have done. President Obama, for example, 563 drone strikes he authorized. He did more in his first year than George W. Bush did in his 8 years. He went after an American citizen in Yemen, for example, but he was suspected of being a terrorist, killed him in Alawi, and then his son was there as well. So what he's doing, I don't think, is any different than what previous presidents have done.
Yeah, and I think that also we're just looking for things to bring up. It's like a lull period. So, you know, people start to go on vacations, politicians start to quiet down a little bit. You don't see them working as much. You know, the articles of impeachment are just in linger. They need something to be angry about, and we're getting a lot of that going on.
Well, I will say, though, if you're a strict constitutionalist, you can make the argument that the only way to use military action is Congress has to declare war. That's kind of the libertarian view. That's a very strict constitutional view, is that you can make the argument that Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Gulf War were all unconstitutional because Congress did not take the time to technically declare war.
I guess, does a drone strike constitute war, though? I don't know.
If you take that very literalist conservative approach of it, then yes. I mean, technically, if you launch a drone strike, you would have to get Congress not only to authorize but to declare war. But most people are not that. Most people do not take that very strict interpretation. Most people are more, I guess it's almost like in the Constitution. I always say that for every amendment, there's always the quote unquote word reasonable that's kind of invisible in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And most people do not take stuff literally to the letter of the law.
Yeah. Rich Rubino from American Politics on the Rocks is his book. You can look him up online. Just do a Google search for Rich Rubino. I wanted to talk about what happened this weekend with Warren and Biden in the power of endowments. You were monitoring that, and that's something that's not really getting reported, but it's a pretty big deal.
The power of endorsements, yes.
Yeah. Oh, endorsements, excuse me. Yes.
I was trying to find out the endowments.
I thought, but the I'm looking at it the other way. So, like the endorsement side of things, you had Julian Castro out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, What's the thing that they say, like, if a tree falls in a forest and no one's around, does it make a noise? It seems like Julian Castro didn't have much support to begin with, so I don't know how much that's going to be a factor. You mentioned earlier with Bernie Sanders, and maybe he got a bump after AOC gave him an endorsement. So I guess not all endorsements are equal. Some actually put a pretty big punch.
Oh, no, absolutely. That was one, and they can actually be counterintuitive, too. For example, Howard Dean back in 2004... he was running as the insurgent presidential candidate. He was running as the anti-establishment candidate. But a couple weeks before the election in Iowa, first of all, Tom Harkin, the senator from Iowa, endorsed him. Then Al Gore endorsed him, and Bill Bradley endorsed him, the two candidates for the 2000 presidential race. And when they endorsed him, it actually had a backlash because now Howard Dean was seen as the establishment candidate. And that's why he had always tried to advertise himself as being anti-establishment. That was an interesting one. I think endorsements themselves, in terms of, for example, Julian Castro, I think he's probably looking more for his own political interests, and what he would certainly love to have a Warren Castro ticket, something to that effect. But I don't think, you know, his quarter of 1% that supporters that he have is going to make that much of a difference for supporting Elizabeth Warren any more than, for example, Tim Ryan, the congressman from Ohio, who was in the presidential race, had about the same support. He endorsed Joe Biden. It didn't necessarily strike a resonant chord with people. But what it does show, first of all, it shows that in Joe Biden's case, it shows that he has the establishment with him. It shows that he's been there for a long time. Now, that can benefit you and disbenefit you. It benefits you because it gets you positive press. But on the other side, it shows that, you know, he's the establishment candidate. Why is he getting all the establishment people running and supporting him? And I can see an insurgent candidate saying, you know, he's got the support of the establishment because they all want to make deals with him because he's part of you. And these are all Washington politicians, something to that effect. I think actually an interesting, for Joe Biden, an endorsement would be for somebody who's anti-establishment, who perhaps endorsed Bernie Sanders last time. And in Bernie Sanders' case, you know, he keeps getting these endorsements. If he starts to get endorsements from people who are part of the establishment, or if Elizabeth Warren starts getting endorsements from them, people might look at one of the other candidates, actually, and say, you know, I want somebody who's really outside of the establishment, outside of Washington. So it can kind of work two ways. I think a very important one is probably in 1992. a couple of ones, actually. And one of them was 1992. Bill Clinton got the endorsement of Sam Nunn, and the senator from Georgia, Ben Jones, the congressman from Georgia, and Zell Miller, the governor of Georgia. And he ended up winning Georgia after losing Iowa, losing New Hampshire. And had he lost Georgia, he probably would have dropped out at that time. And the other one that really important was back in 1976, not 1980, but 76. So Gerald Ford was running against Ronald Reagan. Reagan was running an insurrectionist campaign. He lost the first six states. Then it got to North Carolina. And in North Carolina, Jesse Helms, who was really a legend in the conservative movement, endorsed Reagan over Ford. And that showed conservatives that, you know, this was really our guy. And then Reagan won a few more primaries to the point that it went all the way to the convention, and Ford barely eked out a victory. Those were probably the two most important. Another one, by the way, in 1992, Bill Clinton, when he was running, a reporter told him off air, he was doing satellite interviews, he do a bunch of satellite interviews all over the country, that Jesse Jackson had endorsed his opponent, Tom Harkin. And Bill Clinton looked at him and said, you know what, I think that is a backstabbing thing to do. Shame on him, basically, for doing that. Of course, Tom Harkin, he had not endorsed Tom Harkin. The reporter had gotten misinformation.
Uh-oh.
So Clinton then had to call up Jesse Jackson and apologize for his harsh words.
Oh, no. That can backfire real quick. All right, just hypothetically speaking, let's say you're a candidate, you got 23%, you're in a dead heat, you're going into the first primary. Would you rather have the endorsement of a high-ranking politician, or would you rather have a very well-loved celebrity in your corner going to the last push for Iowa?
With a few exceptions, for example, if Iowa, I could think of Tom Vilsack, who's already endorsed Joe Biden. If he were to come, a former governor, very popular there, former agriculture secretary, if he endorsed someone last week, that would matter for Iowa. Other than that, I would want to get somebody a celebrity, because there's going to be a lot more attention when that celebrity endorses somebody. If Barbara Streisand comes out and endorses somebody, people are going to say, well, why did Barbara Streisand, why did 50 Cent, why did Snoop Dogg, why did Situation, why did Snooki endorse that person? You get a lot of free media. Especially, by the way, if you're at a 23%, but what if you're like somebody, another candidate, what if you're like Michael Bennett, the senator from Colorado, who's at 1% in the polls right now, and all of a sudden, you know, someone like 50 Cent comes in and says, I'm supporting Michael Bennett, and all the media is going to say, why is 50 Cent supporting Michael Bennett? Then Michael Bennett can then go out and give his message.
But
that probably will not happen.
Yeah.
The other one, very important, South Carolina, always very important, Jim Clyburn, the House Majority Whip in the House in the United States Congress, very popular congressman from South Carolina. If he were to endorse somebody the last week of the campaign, that could be a game changer. But he's probably one of the very few people who could potentially do that.
All right. So if you were running, who don't you want the endorsement from?
John Edwards would be one.
David Duke.
David Duke. Donald Trump would be another one.
Oh, you think so right now?
If Donald Trump comes out and endorses, and one thing I've noticed, and it's interesting, whenever he talks about candidates, he calls, you know, when he goes about Elizabeth Warren, it's Pocahontas, it's Sleepy Joe. For some reason, he has this respect for Bernie Sanders. When Bernie Sanders announced his candidacy, they asked Donald Trump, and he said, well, you know, I respect him. We disagree. We agree on trade, and we really agree on that, and I wish him the best. It almost makes you think that there's some sort of Machiavellian thing that he wants Bernie Sanders for some reason to be the nominee so that he can go after him, because he's the only candidate that he really does not go after, if you notice.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, if Donald Trump comes out and says, you know, I want you to vote for Bernie Sanders to my people, that probably would have a backlash in the Democratic Party. So that would be one, I guess.
All right, let's say, okay, let's just throw this out there. You're a little behind, and you have the ability, you can pick. Let's say Hillary Clinton comes out and tries to help you, okay? I don't know if that would be good or bad, but let's say Hillary Clinton on one side, or you can get the endorsement from someone a high profile, like, let's say, Oprah or Tom Hanks or someone like that.
Oh, Oprah or Tom Hanks.
You take
that
over Hillary
Clinton?
Well,
not Tom Hanks so much.
Now, Oprah, though?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oprah, absolutely, first of all, because in Oprah's case, she actually did endorse Barack Obama in 2007, and it helped because a lot of the people who watch Oprah are not people that are necessarily political. They're depoliticized in many respects. They're low-propensity voters. But they like what Oprah Winfrey says, and if Oprah Winfrey comes out, they're going to say, you know what, maybe I'll go out, maybe I'll actually caucus, maybe I'll spend 3 hours, you know, a cold day in Des Moines, Iowa, caucusing for my candidate. In case of Hillary Clinton, I think it would be interesting. If she would endorse Joe Biden, I think that would actually disbenefit him, because people would say, oh, he's just another establishment candidate, he's just like Hillary Clinton. You know, but the only way that her endorsement would really matter, I think, is if she were to endorse somebody, like what if she came out for Andrew Yang, for example?
Mm-hmm.
No one would expect it.
Yeah.
All the coverage in the media would be, hey, Hillary Clinton endorsed Andrew Yang. But that being said, there's no way the Clintons are going to come out and make any sort of endorsement in this presidential race. The closest I know, back in 2004, Wesley Clark, who was from Bill Clinton's home state of Arkansas, entered the race. And a lot of the people who were with Bill Clinton, Congressman Marion Barry, Congressman Mike Ross, David Pryor, the former senator, all endorsed Mike Beebe, the future governor of Arkansas, all endorsed Wesley Clark. Bill Clinton is seen as giving kind of tacit approval, but he would not officially endorse Wes Clark in that election. But I don't think the Clintons in any respect are going to endorse anybody.
You know, they might get Andrew Yang's name right if Oprah or the Clintons come out. All right, so one more time, if people wanted to look you up online, what's a good website?
Yep, just go to Rich Trevino on Facebook. I put up all my interviews, and you can go to www.polita-geek.com.
And, of course, your book, American Politics on the Rocks, people can look up on Amazon.com, a great place for it there. Rich Trevino, thank you so much for joining us again on Overnight America. And you know what? Isn't there a debate next week?
I believe that there is, yes.
And then next month, there's three in February, and it's a short month.
Yes, and we'll see. I might be going to the one in New Hampshire, so I'll keep you updated.
Oh, exciting. Thank you, Rich.
Thank you.
That's our guest, Rich Trevino. He comes on Mondays, and I really enjoy our time together on the TDK Technologies guest line. It's Overnight America, KMOX.
This is Overnight America, sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com on KMOX.
I got to say, I thought it was absolutely hilarious last night at the Golden Globes with Ricky Gervais. Just shut up about politics already. Shut up! You know, it's one of those deals where someone starts talking about it, there's a couple of different ways you can react to it. Reaction number one, you politely just start thinking about something else in your head because you're thinking to yourself, I really don't want to go through this right now. Reaction number two, you defend and you fight to the death whatever your beliefs are. That's reaction number two. Reaction number three, and this is starting to become a much more popular reaction to it all. At the top of your lungs, you just go like this. Shut up! You just yell it as loud as you can and let everyone in a basically, you know, 1 mile radius of you know that this is now going to be a turn off in your mind. You're going to zone it out. And whatever you say from here on out, all you're thinking of is, I wish this person would just shut up. Ricky Gervais realizes that most people, if not all people, feel this way when a celebrity tries to do this to him. And at the Golden Globes last night, I played this clip maybe two or three times, and I don't care. I'm going to do it again tonight because it's so funny. Because he's in a group of all the Hollywood elite. They're all watching. They're at the Golden. I mean, all the biggest names in Hollywood are there. Besides Russell Crowe, who's over in Australia, you know, fighting the wildfires. But all of them are there. They're in one room. They're having a good time. They're patting themselves on the back. They're saying, oh, we are so influential. We're very good at reading a script. And now everyone needs to know what I believe on this thing. And I'm going to try to go and let everyone know how much I hate Donald Trump. Now, whatever Ricky Gervais believes about this, he probably hates Donald Trump too. But he's at least tired of celebrities trying to pretend that they are the utmost authority on any of these topics when it comes to politics, and he decided to let her rip last night. One of the big things he brought up, he was talking about all the different new streaming services, Apple being one of them, all right? And he had to mention, okay, hey, the morning show's on there, and all the stars that are going to these streaming services, okay?
Made by a company that runs sweatshops in China. So, well, you say you're woke, but the companies you work for, I mean, unbelievable. Apple, Amazon, Disney. If ISIS started a streaming service, you'd call your agent, wouldn't you? So, if you do win an award tonight, don't use it as a platform to make a political speech, right? You're in no position to lecture the public about anything. You know nothing about the real world. Most of you spent less time in school than Greta Thunberg. So, if you win, right, come up, accept your little award, thank your agent and your God. And
then he says, get the blank off the stage, shut up about politics.
So,
all right. And you know what? He's doing them a favor. He's doing these people a favor. Please shut up about it all. Oh, man. And the looks and the reactions from people there. I think maybe if a lot of the types have, you know, they have their opinions, and I'm sure that they're allowed to speak their opinions and do this and that. But this is what it comes down to. If you're an entertainer, an actor, and all of these things, and you're going out of your way to make sure you're screaming at the top of your lungs about how much you hate someone, and half of your audience rolls their eyes and say, oh, come on, not another one. You're doing yourself a disservice. I don't think a lot of people care. Maybe Ricky Gervais is doing this for their own benefit. Just shut up already. You find out that even some of the, I would say the untainted, the ones that have been able to maintain that, I know people are watching me for the entertainment value of whatever's on the screen or whatever the music is or things like that. I think they realize that that's why people are consuming them, not because they care about what they think about Donald Trump or something like that. You know, they're not trying to make this big grand political scheme. I just was laughing so hard. Golden Globes were so off my radar until last night when everyone on social media were just going crazy about everything Ricky Gervais was saying. Oh, it was just too funny. In the next hour, we're going to be joined by a couple of guests. Kevin Miller, author of Heart of Steel. We're going to start with him right after the news. And he wants to talk about how you can find out a lot when it comes to your family history, and sometimes you're not prepared for what you're about to find, just like himself. And Tom Voss is a co-author of a book called Where War Ends, talking about PTSD and how to deal with it. Both of our guests coming up next on Overnight America. Don't go anywhere. It's KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.